This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
Hello and welcome to this special podcast, which we're recording to mark the publication of our 2026 Mid-Year Global Outlook. I'm Max Julius, and I'm delighted to be joined by an all-star panel of expert speakers. Here in London, we have Emil van den Heiligenberg, our global CIO, Colin Reedy, Head of Active Strategies, and Stuart Hitchcock, Head of Portfolio Management, Private Credit. And in Chicago, we're joined by Jason Shoup, Co-Head of Fixed Income and CIO, L&G Asset Management America, and David Barron, Global Head of Index and ETFs. Hello, everyone.
Good afternoon, Max.
Hello, good to be here.
It's great to have you all on the pod. Before we start looking ahead, we should probably dwell on the remarkable first half of 2026 for investors. How would you characterize its key themes? And how do they inform our thinking for the second half of the year?
Yeah, thanks, Max. It's already been a fascinating market for the first half year. I think you see sort of two dominant drivers. And if we are really, really honest, that's probably also the surprises we've seen versus our outlook, which we had in the beginning of the year. That's sort of the acceleration of AI. And then the second one is the geopolitical environment and obviously the geopolitical crisis we see currently in Iran. In this backdrop, equity markets have actually rallied, which, given the sort of geopolitical risk, might be a surprise if you would have thought that beforehand. But this is supported by resilient economic growth, and most importantly, it's by much, much better than expected earnings growth. And that's not only in tech stocks, but that's also in sort of not the non-tech sector where that sort of earnings growth starts to come through as well. At the same time, we see interest rates, they are up because they had to absorb sort of three trends. One is the inflation threat coming from higher oil prices because of the Iran conflict. The second one is the switch of central bank expectations. In the beginning of the year, we sort of we penciled in cuts of central banks, especially of the Fed, and now sort of the market is pricing some hikes going forward. And then the last one is the potential tidal wave of issuance as well, mostly by funding the AI infrastructure. The trend in geopolitics are fascinating, but are also quite scary at the same time in a way as well. Eric Lloyd, one of our economists, has been publishing on this a lot, and he called this the return of realpolitics. And Prime Minister Mark Carney, during the World Economic Forum in Davos, also sort of in his speech touched upon that as well. And we've seen a rupture of global order. We've seen the end of rule-based liberal international order. And like-minded states, which were used to cooperate quite well, there is now much more of a great power rivalry going on. And Carney noted the reality is that strong states can act without constraints and weaker states must endure these kind of consequences. That's sort of the tectonic shift which we've seen in geopolitics. But despite all this, AI has been the more powerful source. It impacts productivity, it impacts capital allocation, its impact earnings, and it impacts relative performance between assets as well. And it's so profound that it's going to shape the outlook for the foreseeable future, I would say.
Well, thank you very much for that overview, Emil. My takeaways there, lots of surprises for investors. Let's dig in now to some of the themes you just raised with Jason. Jason, in our outlook, you note that in addition to a CapEx splurge, the AI story that Emil just referenced is fundamentally changing dynamics across industries. How does this change the way you think about risk in fixed income?
Yeah, thanks, Max. Definitely AI has been this mega theme this year, and I suspect it's going to continue to be so next year and in the next couple of years to come. I think in fixed income, it's really helpful to recognize it's not just the sector story around the hyperscalers, right? There's really three major considerations in my mind for the asset class. First, there's the supply story that Emil already mentioned. AI is extraordinarily capital intensive in terms of it, the build out required. You have data centers, you have compute, you have power infrastructure. It's all requiring a huge amount of upfront investment. And a lot of it, as we've seen over the last 6 months, is being funded by the debt markets. So we've seen a real step change in issuance across fixed income. You're seeing more bond supply coming into the market. It's competing with already large government deficits. Public markets, the investment grade market in the US, is running about 20% ahead of where it was this time last year. High yield markets are doing quite a bit of financing too on the public side. They're running 50% ahead of where they were this time last year. And that's only the public side. The private markets are clearly going gangbusters as well, financing a lot of this build. For the most part, the supply has been absorbed well, thanks to those higher nominal yields, I think, that are being caused by the conflict in the Gulf, as Emil spoke about. But in a lower yield environment, it would likely pressure valuations to a much greater degree if you were to have this much supply. The second way that AI is impacting fixed income, I think, is through disruption. You're definitely seeing AI reshape existing industries. Specifically, this year has been about software and SaaS. And that means credit risk is becoming much more kind of about business model durability, right? We spent a lot of time in fixed income over the years and credit investors thinking about leverage, thinking about cash flows, thinking about balance sheets. I mean, I guess that still all very much matters, but you have this like additional overlay, right? And it really is the company a beneficiary of AI, or are they at risk of being disrupted by it? And that's a much more difficult problem for investors to grapple with in an asset class like credit or fixed income more broadly. So we are starting to see much greater dispersion across issuers, even though credit spreads are at this very narrow range over the past 30 years. And then finally, I just say that there's this macro piece that matters a ton for fixed income too. AI has the potential to, you know, definitely drive stronger productivity growth, but it can also create pockets of labor market weakness or tightness, right? I think as time goes on, it's unclear which will be the case. So you can get these sort of unusual combinations, right? You can get growth that looks really good at the aggregate level, but have, you know, underlying stress in parts of the economy. You might get really strong CapEx alongside really weak consumer demand. That's not a typical cycle. Right. And so it's having us have to rethink quite a bit around how we position portfolios. So, again, I guess in conclusion, you have more supply, you have more dispersion, and you have a wider range of macro outcomes that you all have to take into account with fixed income markets.
Thanks, Jason. That is clearly a very helpful framework for investors to think about how the AI revolution is completely reshaping the investment landscape. It also provides an excellent segue to our next question to Colin in terms of the macro point you just made. Colin, in December, you spoke very memorably on our last podcast, pre-outlook podcast, about the growing fiscal is fab club. So to what extent are those elevated yields that Jason just mentioned, are those yields making the club a less pleasant place to be? And what does this mean for investors?
Thanks, Max. Well, the elevated yields are certainly helping attract inflows into the fixed income asset class. That's for sure. But to your point about how pleasant it all feels, I guess that depends on why you're investing in bonds in the first place and what other risk assets you might be managing alongside your portfolio as part of your asset allocation. The reason I say that is the 3 month correlation between the S&P and the 10-year US Treasury is actually the most negative since 1997. And depending on how you slice and dice the data, going back a lot further than that, there are a number of pretty powerful forces at play here as usual, but in no order of importance. I'd cite the US economic growth narrative currently, as measured by economic statistics, coming out better than expected, better than the consensus economic forecast was expecting. The US is on a run of 500 consecutive days where their economic surprise index has been in positive territory. You have to go back to the period when we were finally recovering from the depths of the global financial crisis in 2009 to get a better, more consistent reading. And that was obviously a very different period to what we're seeing today. Secondly, US company earnings have been very robust in Q1. S&P earnings per share grew 28% year on year in the first quarter. Given the well-known stock-specific weighting distortions in the index, you need to look at the Mag 7 and the rest to get a better understanding of what's going on. But even doing that gives you, plus 63% and 17%, both, again, much better than the market was expecting. So this has also helped equity markets ignore or shrug off the recent increases in risk-free yields. And finally, I think how yields rise is important. If it's part of a genuine VAR shock delivering unexpected and violent price action, it's hard for other risk assets to ignore. Remember that the US 10-year is the global risk-free rate of return. But just looking at the volatility of the US bond market shows that we're well below recent highs this year, despite being 60 basis points higher since the start of the war in the Middle East. All taken together, it explains why credit spreads in the main global investment grade indices are in the 0 to 10th percentile using a 20-year history, so super tight. But look at the all-in yields and not spreads, then the same indices are in the 70th to 80th percentile, so super cheap. So the inflows continue, presumably attracted by that cheap all-in yield. And to the extent investors prefer credit risk over government risk, is maybe because of those longer-term fiscal concerns. Either way, they have driven spreads to historically very tight levels, and few seem overly concerned, I have to say. The only other point I'd add finally is this is not just the US. 10-year government bond yields are 50 basis points higher here in the UK and a whopping 70 basis points in Japan year to date. So while less pronounced in Europe, still noticeably higher. So this is a global issue without doubt.
Well, thanks very much for that perspective, Colin. And from fixed income supply, let's now turn to equity issuance. And Dave, great to have you on the call. There are quite a few blockbuster AI IPOs coming to the market over the coming days and months. What do they mean for index and ETF investors?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. Hot topic indeed. Lots of inbound inquiries on what's going on. For starters, the themes that have been mentioned, growth of, the AI tech boom, growth of private markets has driven us to this spot. Companies staying private for longer is a growing theme, and this is kind of the manifestation of some really, really big companies trying to access public markets. But this one in particular, SpaceX and the follow-ons that are expected from Anthropic and OpenAI are really unique. SpaceX is 555,555,555 shares at $135, $75 billion. And to put that into perspective, in 2004, Google raised $1.9 billion. Facebook in 2012, $16 billion. Alibaba in 2014, $25 billion. Aramco 2019, $29 billion. So nearly three times larger in capital raised than the largest IPO in the US in history. So absolutely massive. And there's really two interesting things, though, about this, and where a lot of the questions and confusion maybe comes from. But the big one is, many indices would not allow SpaceX into their index methodologies as rules have been currently written. And so they've gone to consultation to change the rules to create some space, no pun intended there, to get this particular company in the future mega cap IPOs in. So S&P went to consultation, the Russell Index Series went to consultation, MSCI already allows for SpaceX in based on their rules. And the big debatable item was it's all about the free float. So at $75 billion capital raise, that represents approximately only 4% of the total company. And most indices have a minimum free float requirement. So that's in order to protect investors and liquidity that's needed to be able to replicate these indices. So that was the big sticking point. S&P has not changed their methodology. They're going to stick to it. And so it's going to be a bit of time before SpaceX can get into that index series, but the Russell series has changed, and so we may see SpaceX enter quickly. The other big thing that comes up with these IPOs is this just going to increase my concentration risk? So if it's going into Russell indices, I've got another mega tech name, you know, Mag 7 becomes Mag 8, potentially the Mag 11. You know, what does that mean? Because the float is so low, and this is a big area of confusion for investors, these indices typically are free float adjusted market cap indices. So you'll take the full size of SpaceX and you'll multiply it by that 4% float and you'll get the weight in the underlying index. So it'll be very, very small, bottom of the Russell 1000, not the top. So you don't get that concentration risk short term. Should lockups expire or they issue new shares, obviously that could change over time. But I think, you know, that's the important bit is, you know, this will be in some mainstream indices, some of them short term, some of them longer term. But the amount of capital being allocated, at least from passive investors, will be reasonably small.
That's a really helpful explanation of both the kind of the staggering numbers involved, but then also the underlying mechanics of the index providers. Well, let's continue our whistle-stop tour of asset classes now to private markets. And Stu, also fantastic to have you with us. There is a huge amount of media and investor interest right now in private credit. Which areas of the asset class do you think might be most resilient, and what risks are you most closely watching as well?
Yeah, thanks, Max. So the overarching word I'm going to leave listeners with is definition. And that's because the private markets are such a broad church, and it's really important to unpack them before determining which parts of the markets are attractive or not. As you'll know, we are principally investment grade and, if you like, double B kind of crossover investors, long-term buy and hold capital. And, you know, the drivers of our markets are exactly the same as drive the wider fixed income markets. In that regard, the markets which are constituted or comprised of corporates, infrastructure, real estate and alternative debt financings have been remarkably resilient. The supply and demand dynamics are very strong, which obviously puts pressure on credit spreads, but also the structural protections have remained very robust as well. What I think is really interesting, though, is that over the last 12 months or so, as public markets have compressed, whilst private IG has compressed in terms of the premium, it hasn't compressed as much, funnily enough. We're probably running 20 to 30 basis points of so-called illiquidity premium above the long run average. And I think that really reflects a couple of things. One is discipline in the private markets, meaning not following fully the wider market compression, but also increased issuance in some newer asset classes, which are now core asset classes, such as asset-backed finance and data centers. I think if, you know, I was to compare it high level to other parts of the private credit space, obviously this is where we come back to the noise that you'd alluded to. Now, that's really the direct lending space, which are, you know, funds that are invested in the underlying kind of single B and below loans. There's obviously some headline situations with the underlyings and redemption dynamics that have put that market very much in the headlines. I would expect those headlines to continue over the coming year or so, particularly because you've got relatively stubborn rates, you've got ongoing energy inflation, tech disruption, and all manner of other kind of wider issues. But fundamentally, there are some fantastic fund managers and funds out there, so you really have to look through to the underlying. Because there's not as much leverage in some of those funds as one might think. So overall, very much attracted by the investment grade play at this particular part of the cycle, and lots of opportunities across different asset classes, but selectivity is key.
Okay, thank you. That's very clear. It's a great summary and some demystification as well, Stu. Good. So as we edge towards the conclusion of this podcast, we're going to enter now a quick fire round of questions that we've run with some success in previous editions, where I will ask each of our speakers for one non-consensus view about markets over the coming 6 months and beyond, with a very brief explanation. And let's actually remain with you, Stu.
Okay, well, I'm hoping that my colleagues don't laugh at me here, but I'd like to kind of pull the carpets up a little bit and say the world has changed quite significantly over the last couple of years with the burgeoning of AI. And sovereign balance sheets look very different today than they did in the past. So I think that we could see a slight change to the credit spread orthodoxy. And what I mean by that is, you know, in environments where, let's say, we have events, recessions, stagflationary environments, you expect a normal cycle, economic deterioration, weaker corporates, credit spreads rise. We talk all the time about credit spreads being tight and when do they rise. And I wonder if actually we've got an early shift in the hierarchy of credit risk. So, you know, is it a new world order where actually the way we think about spreads and relative value changes? Is the benchmark truly the sovereign anymore? And actually, could we be looking at particular sectors like big tech, utilities, that look a little more sovereign-like in their resilience than the sovereign itself?
Okay, thanks, Jude. Are we in a new world order? Let's find out. Colin?
So looking ahead, one of the big calendar items that you have to be focused on as an investor is obviously the November midterms. And there is a growing negative backlash to AI in the US at the moment. It's more than just Bill Gates being booed at college graduations. It looks to be more substantial and has got a bit of a whiff of a sort of generational conflict about it. So it'd be key to watch that develop, I think. In terms of the political bit, I think the US tends to sort of kick off the process of the next presidential race after the midterms of the final incumbent's final term, effectively. So, you know, I guess, is there a risk of some form of anti-AI ticket coming out of that? That would have pretty profound implications if regulation was going to become a political hot topic for valuations and for everything that we've discussed on this podcast effectively. I hope they don't, obviously. I think this is super exciting technological development. It's a privilege to have a front row seat on this transition, but with all these big changes, they come with potentially unintended consequences.
Yeah, that's a super interesting view of a potential AI populist backlash. Dave, great moment to come to you for your non-consensus view.
Yeah, I'm going to lean into Colin's theme here and say, you know, more regulators are going to figure out how to catch up to some of these emerging themes, which is going to slow down a lot of progression. I'm going to pick tokenization as something that, you know, everyone's getting really excited about. Tokenize everything that moves is the current trend or what you see in the news. And I just think when the regulators start figuring out what that means and the downstream implications, I think that trend starts to not reverse, but materializes over a lot longer period than others are saying.
Okay, regs versus tokenization. Good, thank you. Jason, over to you.
Yeah, I guess notwithstanding Stuart's comments, which I think are being tested in the market a little bit, you know, what Colin's saying and what Dave is saying here, I don't think credit really looks priced for disruption right now at all. And so my sort of non-consensus view would be that we end with spreads in the US that are wider than where they are today, right? We end the year. Dispersion is up this year. I mentioned that before. It's really unusual to see dispersion be up at the same time that you see spreads as tight as they are or as narrow as they are. Those two are usually correlated with each other. So something feels like it's got to give there. And I guess you might say, well, how non-consensus is that view really? Everyone in credit tends to be bearish on credit when we're at valuations like we are right now. I guess maybe the one added bit I throw in there is, which sectors might be the most resilient if we start to see a deterioration in credit? I think that is something that requires a little bit of thinking through. Something like the bank sector has been super popular as an overweight for a lot of portfolio managers for the last 5 years. One of the reasons it's been really popular is that there's been a little bit of value there, but it's also been like this sector that you can hide from M&A. You didn't have to worry about like a big bank waking up and doing a kind of acquisition the next day when you get animal spirits starting to appear in the economy. And I think we'd all agree that like the animal spirits have been like a whole zoo has been unleashed, this year in terms of animal spirits. My concern there is I'm not sure that that's the sector that's the most resilient to, AI risks. You're starting to see definitely disruption in companies that are being lent to by banks, or the companies that do the lending are being lent to, one order of, a degree of separation by the banks. And you're also starting to see stress on the lower end consumer in this type of an economy. So I'm less enthusiastic about banks. I don't think that's the safe place to hide. I think you've got to start looking at industrials. And a lot of these, heavy asset industrials could become the new safe sector. And when I think about a sector that really has a chance to be as bulletproof as maybe a sovereign, as Stuart was sort of to allude to, I start to think about defense companies, pharma companies, maybe some healthcare companies. And so I think the safety sector is changing. And I'd be alive to that risk as the year progresses.
Okay, that's another interesting view we will gather in 6 months. We can look at how those sector dynamics have played out there. Emil, your non-consensus view.
Well, my first non-consensus idea is obviously the Netherlands will be crowned world champion of football this summer. No one believes that, so that must be completely out of consensus. Not even a proper Dutchie believes that, so that's a non-consensus view. But a bit more serious, there's a lot of talk about AI and energy demand. If you look at AI, it demands a lot of energy to use, and the infrastructure which is building, there's a lot of energy demand behind that as well. And that has obviously challenges for climate change and our investors who care a lot about climate change as well. There's an idea that makes me optimistic, and that is that AI can also be a force for good in terms of climate change. Our energy system is inherently inefficient. I'm told that 1/3 of all the energy is actually used. The rest is used to sort of generate the energy. So that also means if it's so inefficient, that it's also ripe for technological advancement. And obviously that is really, really going to be supported in the future by AI. So my non-consensus idea would be that AI is going to prove itself as one of the best shots we have to advance in energy efficiency and things like which we need as well, like carbon capturing as well. And that would obviously be fantastic news for climate change.
Well, that's a great optimistic note with which to wrap up this section. And actually, we've covered a lot of ground today. Looking back at our last 20 minutes together, what would you say are the key takeaways for investors?
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating to hear the insights of our top investors today. And I scribbled quite a lot. But what I sort of the common denominators I saw between everyone, all the investors talking today, and the world has changed significantly in the past years. AI will be with us for a long time, and we will talk in many, many podcasts going forward about its impact in macro space, but also in the individual asset classes which we discussed today. In fixed income, we see much more issuance, we see dispersion between securities, which must mean it's going to be a very positive environment for us, where we spend a lot of time on fundamental research, whether that is in public markets or whether it's in private credit as well. And Stu tied into that with selectivity is key, definition is key. And then lastly, we're going to see a wide range of macro outcomes. That was mentioned today as well. And is the next cycle completely different than the cycle we've used to? Multiple speakers have spoken about that. That, again, makes me fascinating and curious to sort of see what's going to happen in the next quarters.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that great summary there, Emil. And again, even more positivity about the months and years ahead. Also, finally, I will just ask everyone on the call what you are planning to watch, read, or listen to over the coming summer months. And I'll get the ball rolling and say I'm finishing a series on Amazon, and it's a drama series about the making of The Godfather. And it's called The Offer. And it's wonderful, and can't recommend it enough, especially as a big fan of the original first two films, less so the third one. Emil,
I'm going to train myself over the summer in AI. I've asked my teammates to come up with podcasts, articles to read, and so on. And I'm going to sort of use that while I'm on holiday, sort of for an hour a day, dare I say. To train myself up. I say to everyone, it's not AI which will replace your job. It's like the person who can really use AI. And I'm sort of want to sort of do what I preach and sort of train myself as well, which I don't have time for on my normal days of work.
Great. Train yourself to replace yourself, essentially.
No way.
Dave.
Watching World Cup, of course. Let's go USA. I hope we. I wouldn't dare pick a non-consensus view on their outcome, so I stayed far away from it. On the book side, there's a book called Gödel, Escher, Bach, which is about those three: a mathematician, an artist, and a musician. Really interesting read, long, heavy book, but it has parallels into the. One of the major questions is whether or not AI can truly think outside the box. Will we have the concept of a singularity? The view in this book, written in 1979, which was kind of around the first AI boom, was no. Machines will be confined to the system of rules that they're in. And the hypothetical, that kind of they ask is, would AI, if you fed all the information up to the point at which Einstein invented general relativity, would an AI be able to have invented general relativity? And the answer theoretically is no. Currently, if you ask AI that question, it says no, it couldn't figure it out. We'll see where we get to in the coming years. But anyway, good book, highly recommended.
Sounds fascinating. Thank you, Jason.
Yeah, mine's not as deep as that one. I'm a couple of years behind, I think, in current literature. I am reading, because it feels timely, I'm reading and finishing up the Walter Isaacson biography on Elon Musk. And it is great background reading, as I'm sure many people have already read, as we get ahead into this SpaceX IPO. And I'm also eagerly anticipating the very large bond deal that I expect that SpaceX will do on the follow after becoming a public company that I'll have to figure out whether we're going to buy or not in our active funds.
Okay, good. Thank you for that, Stu.
I'm now seriously lowbrow. I am one of those terribly enthusiastic home cooks. Imagine the Swedish chef, but worse. So I'm going to make my way through one of Marcus Waring's cookbooks over the summer and see where that leads me.
Excellent. Look forward to the invite.
Yeah, wonderful. College.
So it's a book, and sort of continuing the theme, I guess. It's called Artificial Organizations by a guy called Barry O'Reilly. It's ordered but not yet read. But the thesis is that AI isn't replacing leaders, it's exposing them. And the interest for me is that I think the sheer pace of the shift to this AI world, combined with the challenges of operating in the multipolar post-pandemic environment that we've touched upon already, has got the ability to really expose low-quality management teams. The decisions they're having to take at the moment are as strategically significant as they come for the C-suite, I think, and they're not cheap decisions either. And are going to have a profound implications for sort of who thrives and who doesn't.
Thank you. That's an important point on which to end today's call. So thank you all. Thank you, Emil, Jason, Dave, Colin, and Stu for sharing your insights with our clients and listeners today. And thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. You'll be able to find our global outlook on our website and see our other updates on our social media channels, our blog, and of course, here on our podcast, L&G Talks Asset Management.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LG Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.